For me, peace really is not a state of no movement. Peace is very active. And so when I say that we're at peace with God, that's not something that's like, oh, a calm lake, there's nothing happening. Actually, God's peace is very energetic, there's movement. And so I think when peace is not, and when God is present, it's not just everything's at peace and I'm happy. And it's like God is teaching, but so lovingly, he shines light with bright colors. It's beautiful. It's convicting, but it's beautiful.
Irena Dragos Jansen is a freelance writer who explores the power of art and faith. During the 1990s, she and her family were refugees of the war in Croatia and Bosnia. Now a U.S. citizen and married to her husband, Scott, she's pursuing a master's degree in art history at George Mason University and is involved in program and resource development of nonprofits in Croatia. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Irena Dragos Jansen, it is a pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
It's my pleasure. I was so taken by an article you wrote recently in Comment Magazine. We'll get to that in a minute. I begin by asking my guests how faith figures into their life and work. And this is interesting in your case because you were raised in a Christian home in what is now Croatia. And as you write in one of your articles, I'm quoting you here, I thought back to my parents and how they'd managed to live a vibrant and authentic Christian faith in a country whose political system and moral values did not represent their Christian and personal values and beliefs. They passed on this hopeful, remnant way of living to my siblings and me. So, faith was important to your family when you were young, but has it always been important to you personally? Or, like many people, did your faith only become meaningful to you as you entered adulthood?
That's a great question. So I would say the faith that my parents instilled or modeled for us really gave me a foundation which is still very relevant. And sometimes I joke and say that how I grew up, it was like putting me through boot camp of Christianity, all the lessons and Bible and memorizing Bible. And so that really was, it's just such a foundation that the older I get, I keep going back to it more and more and realizing how important it is and how much I draw from that. But I would say that my faith journey has been a continuous development of a relationship. And like any good relationship, it goes through seasons, it develops, and hopefully we get to know the other person more and more. So that has been my journey with God as well. And through various things that happened in my life, some were more dramatic, some less dramatic. But I would say I had, I don't know if that's the proper theological term, but like second and third conversion, where it was like this big aha moment. And it's like, oh, wow, now I understand this more, or now I've come back to the truth. So I've had those big aha moments, those continuous conversions of this relation being developed and my faith becoming more and more my own. But the more it becomes my own, I keep going back to my parents and that foundation. So it's kind of a combination.
Sure. Okay. I like the description of you're building a relationship with God through a series of continual conversions. That I like that description a lot. That rings true to me. And we're going to get more into this actually, because your article touches on some of these things. Let's discuss this recent article that I read in Comment Magazine titled Wars and Peace, Reflections on Ukraine and the Blur of Past and Present. I was so grateful, Irena, to come across this article because it speaks so beautifully and from such a privileged vantage point about the anxiety so many of us are feeling, right, as tragic events continue to unfold in Ukraine. And as you point out in the article, the war there feels very personal to you, having lived through war yourself, right? And having still people who are close to you living in Ukraine. And you had me gripped with this paragraph early in the article. This is quoting you again. When the war in Ukraine slowly crept up and then exploded, I was instantly overwhelmed by a flood of memories. the high-pitched noise of an incoming missile, the air raid sirens, the feeling of helplessness at the sound of a low-flying fighter plane, hiding in the basement during bombing, our family fleeing and becoming refugees, the fear, the unknown, the chaos. I mean, that's really chilling, you know. So my question, I guess to start with is this: when war broke out in Croatia when you were a teenager, did you fear for your life? And how soon was it after the outbreak of the war before your family knew you needed to flee?
So a simple question is yes, we did fear for our lives, especially when that big attack happened. And when the quote that you read, that was the experience, the planes flying above our house, the bombing, the soldiers and tanks going down the street. And then that continued even after we fled, because the fighting continued and hiding in the basement. So we feared for our lives. How soon? I might touch on this later too, but you know, in war, it's chaos. Nobody really gives you a loud line and says, now this is what's happening. Now this is the attack. Now you flee and you will become refugee. You don't know. You just do the next step. You live in that very moment and you think the plane is flying. Where is a safe place to go? My father came and rescued us because he wanted us to be close to him. He was working in a neighboring town. And so you don't know that you're becoming a refugee in that moment. And I write about that. You just are like, we're running for our lives and it's not safe here and we want to be together. So the fighting in Croatia and the unrest had been going on for about 2 months before the big attack and before we fled. And we were sleeping on the floor for about a month and a half, because there was fighting going on around our house and you would hear bullets. And so there, it was kind of building up like the what happened in Ukraine. It was slowly building up and then it exploded. But we didn't expect it. You just don't know. Nobody tells you what is going to happen.
It's just so, I mean, it's so chilling, and it really kind of puts a knot in the pit of my stomach. And the way you describe even the sound of an incoming missile, I mean, you know, on TV you see things, you see explosions and you kind of associate it visually, but the chilling sound of a missile, the high-pitched noise, as you put it, I really it's hard for me to get my head around, Irina. It really is. So I guess that leads me to this question here. You describe your reaction to the war in Ukraine as one of trauma. Right, watching this suddenly just raises all these old things. And here's another paragraph from early in your essay, Wars and Peace. You write, "Trauma is not just a memory, it is also a reaction. My body has gone back in time in recent days. The knot in the stomach, the urge to vomit, the burst of tears, the muscle tensing at a sudden noise, the heart rate increase at the sound of a plane. I appear to be sitting in my Virginia home, peaceful, quiet, but I am not here. I'm in Croatia, and it is the 1990s. I am also in Ukraine, and it is 2022. Wow. So let me ask you about the experience of writing this article then, right? Does the memory of war that the article requires you to relive induce in you these feelings of trauma? Or on the other hand, do you find that writing helps you to work through these traumatic memories? In other words, was writing the article more compulsive or more therapeutic for you?
That is such a great question. That's why after I answer, I would like to hear your answer, because it by you asking it, I can tell that you have experience with this and you really understand the depth and the meaning of this. So just quickly to say that even before the war in Ukraine erupted, my trauma and the physical response that my body carries had not really left me. It had been healed and I got better. But if a door slams, I still react more than my husband does or other people. I still react to loud noises. So that my body has been carrying that trauma. And then when Ukraine happened, it all just flooded back in a way that I did not expect it. I mean, the war happened 25 years ago, 30 years ago. And I was overwhelmed by the strength of the physical response that I had to the war in Ukraine, especially because my friend was in the middle of it with her husband and children. And I it affected me on a deep personal level. And so when I started writing, well, first I started talking to some friends from Croatia, my family and friends, we started talking about, this is what's happening. The memories are coming back. We started checking on each other's well-being through texts and phone calls. And I started jotting down fragmented thoughts. And then when Ann Snyder kindly called me and said, would you mind writing something? I said, thank you. Thank you for giving me this gift of my voice being heard and also giving focus to my furious writing, to this diary of fragmented thoughts and emotions that I was putting on the screen. And so that gave me focus. And I told her, you know, when I'm done, if this does not cut it, as it's not good enough to be published, that's okay. You have given me a gift to process this through writing. So my article, it was kind of like a diary. It was processing it, and it was therapeutic. It was healing to know that my voice is being heard, to have a focused way of processing it. It also was a bit traumatic as well, because I was remembering and trying to remember, and told me, can you have some more examples after she read the initial article? And then I spent, that was the hardest part to write. Took me a whole day to just go back and write that. And it was kind of this vortex of furiously writing, crying, then writing it, then texting my friend, checking on her. It was just really vortex. But I would say overall, it was a gift to be heard, just like this is. Thank you for allowing my voice to be heard. So it was a gift, and it was therapeutic. It focused my my thoughts.
Wow. Thank you so much. You know, and I did not know that Ann Snyder had reached out to you to write this. You know, she's a former podcast guest here on the Faith and Message podcast. She was wonderful. I really have so much respect for the great works that she does. What you describe is really gut-wrenching, Irena. And I've got to say, remarkably lucid, given the intensity of the feeling that you describe, that you're able to put down your thoughts in such not just a coherent fashion, but really movingly, speaks to your capacity to be able to sort of stretch your mind a long ways to wrap it around all of these traumatic events. Thank you so much for what you've done.
Welcome. If I can just add a quick thing, I think, and we might touch on this later, but when that happened, all those thoughts, and they just erupted, but they really were results, seems like a strange word to use, but of years of walking with God and being healed, of talking to community, talking to my friends in Croatia and in America, processing things, grappling with the idea of peace. I mean, my name, Irena, comes from Greek, Irene, which means peace. So I kind of see it as my lifelong journey to discover what is peace. So I've been grappling this for a long time. It's just when war happened, it all erupted, and it was kind of a gift that my husband wasn't here for those 5 days. He was visiting his family, and so I just stayed in this office for 5 days, just grappling with that, trying to recall all those lessons learned before. So I would say it did not all just happen then. It's an ongoing pursuit of what it means to be at peace and have deep roots.
Okay, which is a great segue to another passage. And I'm going to quote you a lot in this conversation because I love what you write. You have this really beautiful passage about seeking peace that's hopeful, and it jumped out to me. I'm quoting you here. You write, healed scars are not bursting open. Roots of hard-won peace push deeper into its source. The anchor holds. A psalm still lends its words to my lament. A burst of joy cuts through the pain. Beauty takes my breath away. Generosity, kindness, and care soothe the heart. God is present. It is war, and it is also peace. I think that's such a striking passage. Can you describe a bit more? How did you come to this really hard won peace. You know, how did you find this anchor, as you put it, that holds you fast?
Well, I mentioned a little bit that it's been a long and slow but steady journey with God and community. I can't emphasize this enough. Community with the band of brothers and sisters, of talking through things, praying together, being prayed for, processing things, coming to God and asking for healing. So it's been a long journey. And like I said, I kind of find it my lifelong task to try to figure out this peace thing, which I'm named after. And my mom's name is Peace as well, Amira mm-hmm. in Croatian. So it is, it's been a long journey, but also God's miraculous moments. He got the magic ingredient in all this. and if I could just say just a quick little story, when we were refugees and it was like the fourth place that we had lived in, and my sister and I were sleeping on this mattress on the floor. It was the middle of the night. Christmas was coming up. We didn't have any of our things. Our dad was in back working close to the front line. I mean, the situation was not great. We were all together. We were sleeping in the same room. We went to sleep in the same room with my mom. And I remember at night, I couldn't sleep. And I just felt this burst of joy. And I was like, what is this? And it was just this miraculous burst of joy, which later I've learned that, you know, joy is truly a sense of belonging. When you feel like you belong, you know where it belongs. That's this sense of joy. And that's something I have carried ever since. It's this, like, this didn't come from me. It wasn't caused by the circumstances I was in. It was from God. It was God saying, you belong to me. I know you. I see you. I'm with you here. And it's this joy. So that's how I've come to this. I haven't arrived yet. I'm holding on tight. But it's walking with God, slow and steady, community, 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 and God. He's the magic ingredient.
That's so, that seems so authentic to me and really wonderful. You know, in my experience, you know, one of the signs that God's a part of one's existence is that there's always something a little counterintuitive about it. It's not exactly what you expect, right? Yeah, so you're in this moment of high anxiety, you can't sleep, and suddenly there's the presence of joy. I think, yep, that rings true, that right there, that's a hallmark, a watermark for me of God's presence. Yes. You know, one of the points you make, I think really powerfully in your article, is that we rarely live with one pure feeling or another. It's not happiness or misery or grief or so on. Instead, as you put it, and I'm quoting you again, life is a convoluted pattern of sorrow, joy, anger, conflict, resolutions, tensions, kindness, fear, love, generosity, conceit, forgiveness, hatred, pain, healing, chaos, clarity, and God's presence. Always God's presence. I find that refrain at the end of the paragraph about God's presence so beautiful. And here's where things can grow more nuanced and more complex. I'm wondering in light to what you just talked about, have you ever experienced God's presence in your life as a source of some of these more difficult emotions, sorrow or conflict or fear or pain or chaos? Or is that presence in your life always associated with our more peaceful emotions and joy, et cetera?
Another one of those lifelong paradoxes to explore. And I think for me, that was one of those aha moments when I realized, oh, okay, joy and sorrow can coexist at the same time. And my family and I have, you know, in addition to war, a year before the war, my 21-year-old brother died in a car accident with three of his friends coming back from a mission trip. And so that was kind of my first introduction to deep grief and sorrow. And then with the war and all of those things happening. So how can God be present in the middle of sorrow and grief? How can those two things coexist? those two states. And I think, like I said, that has been the aha moment for me. Oh, yes, it can. So even as I was sitting in this very office and looking through my window and crying because of my friend and being overwhelmed, I could still look out the window. And I was like, oh, the bare branch tree that I could see through the window, be overwhelmed by beauty, people calling, offering help, network of connections, money for my friend, people caring for me, remembering, oh, something's happening in Ukraine. Irene, does this bring back trauma? I was so touched that people would remember. So just that commingling, that's just the tip of the iceberg of that commingling, but it really does coexist. And just another quick thing to mention is, you know, for me, peace really is not a state of no movement. Peace is very active. And so when I say that we're at peace with God, that's not something that's like, oh, a calm lake, there's nothing happening. Actually, God's peace is very energetic, very, there's movement. So that's one thing. And then another, does God's peace always just mean a state of like peaceful emotions? No, I think one of the, and just another quick example, God really is, well, he's peace and love, but he's also light, and he shines light on things in our lives and sin as well. And my husband and I were going through a difficult time in our lives with lots of uncertainty, and it was affecting our emotions and our relationship. And I started feeling very spiritual, and like I was doing great, and I was going to prayer and church, and my husband was not going to the same prayers that I was going to. And I felt very superior spiritually. And then God sent me that parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And I realized, oh, this is for me. Like, I was a Pharisee. I felt so spiritually superior. And at that moment, I felt God's presence as light, shining light on my sin. But you know what? It felt peaceful, because when God shines a light, he shines light with one hand, but then he hugs you with the other hand. He's like, I love you. It felt, him shining light felt like freedom. It felt like peace. It was, there was movement. I felt convicted, but it was also like, oh, I don't have to be superior spiritually. I can surrender my husband's life, and God's in control. And so I think when peace is not, and when God is present, it's not just everything's at peace and I'm happy. And it's like God is teaching, but so lovingly, lovingly, he shines light with bright colors. It's beautiful. It's convicting, but it's beautiful. So I'm sorry, that's kind of but so no, peace is not always just a peaceful emotion.
That's great. I love that description, Irena. That is so good. And that rings so true, so beautifully and painfully true to me. I know that when I start feeling okay about my life, you know, God will find some way to shine a light and reveal exactly what's not okay in my character, you know, or my circumstances. And that's, I've got to admit, there's pain in that disclosure, right? But it's not just pain the way I'd feel like shame from being called on the carpet by colleagues or by peers. It's different. It feels very loving, and it puts me back together even as it breaks me down. It's a very interesting, very unique experience.
If I can just give a little plug to the listeners, because I do love art and study art history. I think one of the paintings, or parables first, of Jesus, the prodigal son, but Rembrandt's painting of the prodigal son, and then Henry Nouwen's book about the prodigal son, where he spent a week just looking at the painting. And he pointed out how the father in that painting, the hands that he has on the prodigal son are different. One hand is more, looks more feminine. The other one looks more masculine. And Henry Nouwen says, isn't that amazing? Because that's who God is. When he hugs us, it's both the kind of the feminine, gentle embrace that we usually associate with mothers, and the more kind of firm grip of a father that's saying, okay, have you learned your lesson? And so I think that's just a beautiful image to go back to, those two hands when God shines light and love. And he's the only one really that can do that so magnificently.
That's great. You make me want to go back and look at that painting again. I love Henry Nouwen. And I don't think I've read him talk about that Rembrandt painting. I'm going to go back and both look at that painting. I'm going to read Henry Now and doing it. That's a great suggestion. Thank you very much. So you mentioned looking at your window at bare branches. Let me ask you about that. So one of the vivid images you describe in your article is the feeling of being stripped bare. And as you put it, really strikingly, refugee life is a season of being stripped bare, right? And yet, you know, it's, as you point out, it's also, it's not only in such extreme circumstances that we feel ourselves rendered so vulnerable. And I'm quoting you again. You say, a dear friend recently told me about the challenges she's been facing in her relationship with her daughter. During this season of tensions and life-altering challenges, she dedicated herself to honest personal growth, seeking God's healing and accepting help from her community. My friend said, I was stripped bare. Culturally imposed false beliefs were exposed. Personal issues were revealed. It was painful. And then she proceeds to tell me of how that season of being stripped bare had led to a beautiful new season of greater understanding, growth, and a flourishing relationship. I love that. You've had the experience of being, of feeling stripped bare, right, in the years you spent as a displaced person, as a refugee. Have you had this feeling at other times in life? And if so, does it always strike you as a new experience, or has it become so familiar that when it happens, you say, ah, I've been here before?
Yeah, it seems to be a theme for my life, another theme I'm going to spend my whole life exploring. Yeah, so I have definitely felt that feeling of being stripped bare in other seasons of my life. And I'm grateful for it for many reasons. One, not insignificant, is that I do feel like I can relate more to other people because, you know, when I first came to America and I was talking about losing my brother and the war, people felt like, oh, wow, like I was some kind of a hero and I've experienced these big things and they will never be able to experience that. And then, you know, as I've lived my life, other things have happened that have given me this feeling of being stripped bare. And one of the ones that I will mention is moving to America. Two times when I went to school, but the second time I moved here because I married my amazing, wonderful husband, Scott, and everything was great. I was happily married. I was living, you know, in the land of milk and honey and everything was great, but I had entered a season of really, of depression, which because I had lost my community, I had lost kind of part of my identity. To answer your question, does it always feel the same? No, at first, I was surprised. I didn't recognize it as being stripped bare. I was just not doing well. And it took me a while to realize what was going on. And again, the band of brothers and sisters around me, the community. And then one day I was in prayer with two dear women from church praying for me. And we talked about this and she said, yeah, this is hard, Irena, because when you were going through war, you were going through it with community and you came here and nobody can understand your experience. And I was like, oh, so I think it can surprise us again and again, because it's a new, something different, a different way of being stripped bare. It's not always snow. Sometimes it's a hurricane that comes. Sometimes it's rain. Sometimes it's freezing rain. So it can feel different. But there is also commonality to it. It's this feeling of like everything being taken away and you lose your footing. And so the same feelings, but it feels, it can feel different. But I think, and I'll end with this. I think one thing that I have learned though, is that as I go through these seasons, they really are like seasons. And that's why I'm grateful for how God has really created nature to teach us. It is seasons. I go through a season of being stripped bare and then, you know, the healing and then the flowers and all of that. And then we go back. When the next winter comes, it can surprise me, but I've learned. And it takes me maybe shorter time to get back to, oh, push my roots deeper. This is what's happening. And so there is a learning process. I don't think we ever learn a lesson and just go like, oh, I've learned it and now from now on. But I think the time gets shorter between completely being lost and then remembering what we need to do. And if we have good community, they remind us of that as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I, I'm, I'm going through my own little personal season of winter at present. In a way, it's nothing like what you're describing, what you've been through. It's nothing as massive as that. But it, you know, but we have these seasons. They're not unfamiliar to us. And one of the great points you make in your essay is that, you know, even those who have not lived through war directly still have these seasons of turmoil and chaos and conflict, right? Mm-hmm. That the principles that you've learned are not exclusive to those who have passed through war, but really touch on all of us in some way, which makes this in some ways a more universal experience, even if not in the sense that we're actually on the ground experiencing the most horrifying effects of the wars that we watch on TV.
Yes. No, that is so true. And I think it is a trap that is set by Satan, that when those things that don't seem as big come our way, we think we might be able to handle them ourselves because they're not as big. And then we just sink deeper and deeper. And I think that's what was hard for me, is like, oh, I had handled, you know, death and war. I moved to another country. Okay, I'm capable. I can do this. And actually, one of the ladies praying for me said, you know, your problem is that you're capable. You think you can do this. And so I think I don't think there's smaller or bigger strippings. I think they're all, we feel them, but it's a trap that we think, oh, this is not as big. And then it just grows and grows and becomes bigger. And I think there's value in hardship. And so that's why I wanted to encourage people and say all of our strippings are worth bringing to God and seeking help from community and from God. And like I said, war, in some ways was maybe easier to handle than moving to America.
Wow.
Because I felt so isolated and that nobody else knew my experience. Not even my dear husband could share in it. War, we were all in it together. So every stripping is different.
That's such a rich perspective. That's so good, Irena. Thank you. Let me ask you something about war, and then we'll go to, well, I guess I got a couple more questions I want to ask you about this. All this, I hope that readers will feel inspired to go read this article on the online Comment magazine. It's wonderful. Again, Wars and Peace, it's its title. You conclude your article with these words, quoting you here again. My roots keep pushing deeper. God is present and faithful. He upholds. I take a small step toward my neighbors, not away from them. I love that you end that way. I had thought, I'd hoped that living through a pandemic would bring people together, bring our political divides closer together, and I'm not sure it did that. In fact, I think in some ways it drove a further wedge between all of us. Thus far, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has had a powerfully unifying effect in the West. And I guess, given your own really unique point of view here, does this unifying effect at all surprise you? Or does it in any way concern you?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question. yes. I would say that I'm kind of suspicious of any kind of large movements of large groups, of saying, oh, we as a group are more unified, or we as a group are more divided, or we as a group are now more compassionate. I think that is, again, God's the magic ingredient, and he can do this, but I think it's hard to measure it like that with large groups. I think movement and change really happens on a personal level in our relationship with God, and then in small groups. I mean, this is nothing new. You know, we talk about grassroots movement, but I really think that's where it happens. And I think even during the political divide and the divisions in America, I was so encouraged by how many people I talked to, and even the other article that I wrote for Breaking Ground, I talk about that. Like, there are so many Americans who cared, who engaged, you know, during the war in Croatia, during the political divide, people started grappling with questions. And I would just say that I think what is happening in America now is a great stripping, especially of Christian community, a great stripping of Christian community, like our sense of security, the country that we felt was comfortable and aligned with our Christian values. There's a great stripping. And I think there's a large number of people who are grappling with it. and taking advantage of it and saying it's being stripped. Let's see what really upholds us. And so I was encouraged even during that. I mean, there was lots of bad things that happened during, you know, the political divide still. But I think it is like shaking things up. I think people are talking, they're searching, they're being stripped bare. And we're really seeing the bare branches. What is it that upholds us? So I'm actually really encouraged on personal level, the friends they interact with, groups, and the pandemic. We said, oh, maybe the pandemic will unite us. Well, it provided some good things, and then not. And the same thing with war in Ukraine. Now people are united, but that will also, another new cycle will come. Who knows what's going to happen? So I think as a large movement, it's hard to measure, but I am encouraged. I'm encouraged because I see that God is present and acting in people's lives, and there is progress and movement.
Okay, great. You mentioned that piece that you published in the volume In Breaking Ground. It's titled Observations of a New Citizen, and I want to maybe ask you a question too about that right here. You talk in there about the process of becoming an American citizen, right, and acquiring the ability to vote, which is positive, but also fraught given how fractious we are in our politics at the present. And you touched on some similar themes there in that article as you do in the one on war, which I think is telling, you know, in some ways for the present. But there are some subtle variations. And you do talk about this being stripped bare in some of Christianity, other things that have made us feel sort of stable or secure, and how Christians have been swept into the vortex, you know, of the political animosity in the country. And you say that at first you remained above the fray of all this stuff, then eventually you got caught up in it. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'll try to make it really short. So, you know, when I first was a student here and then later when I just had a green card, I wasn't able to vote. And I was also confused by the American political system. You know, I grew up in a communist country and then a country that became independent, and we were just kind of figuring out our democracy and voting. And so as I write in my article, I felt really safe and comfortable on my observation deck. I was just observing. I didn't have to decide how I was going to vote. I decided not to favor any one party, which frustrated my friends. And but I was just like, I can't. I'm observing. And then once I was able to vote, I'm like, I cannot observe anymore, because also I had learned from Americans that being active and, you know, civic duty is important, which in communism I didn't really know about. so I can vote now. And then I got caught in, who am I going to vote for? Who's going to provide safety? Which party is going to provide safety for me? And being safe is a big deal. That's what the war was about. And I, you know, talk and write about that as well, because that's a theme for me. Safety, we all want to be safe. That's sometimes why wars are fought. We don't feel safe and we want to. And so I thought, oh, one political party is going to provide that safety for me. And I got caught up in it and I became fearful. What if that party doesn't win? And it was horrible. It was horrible because I lost that peace. And in the end, I don't know, maybe I always just have to be by myself for a few days for God to release meet me. I was sick and I spent a few days by myself. And I realized, oh, I had replaced my security, placing my security in God into a political party. Yes, I'm going to do my research. I'm going to do the best I can. I'm going to vote and I'm going to be, you know, active in my community. But, you know, we lived through, going back to my parents, we lived in communism. And that was not aligned with any of our beliefs. And God was present and faithful and active. And so that was it. It was a longer journey, but I finally arrived back to that. I went and I voted, but I placed my trust in God's presence.
That's great. I'll quote you here from that article. You write that I began to realize that the moment I lost my peace was when I took my eyes off Christ and put my hope in the victory of a political party promising to keep me safe. I began to realize that my trust should never have been wavered from the one, capital O, one, who addresses the root of all human problems and gives us eternal hope and ever-present help. I knew that there might be long-lasting and significant consequences to either side winning, but I have lived in a difficult environment before, and God was faithful and present in it. If it should come to that, it is possible to stay true to one's faith and beliefs, even when there is a price to pay. I should not anchor my life in the circumstances around me, but in the one who remains the same, whatever happens. You just spoke to that. It's beautifully articulated, and I really agree more. One thing is certain in America, at least given its history, if you put your faith in a party, you'll be happy about one half the time. And that's true now, even when the parties go further apart and the issues seem more consequential on both sides, right? I think that if you vest your faith just in a single party alone, that is a recipe for short-lived euphoria and long-term trauma.
That's well said. Yeah. Well said. That is so true. And if I can just balance that quote that you read, I don't believe in escapism. I hope the listeners will not think that it's like, oh, I'm just going to trust God and then, you know, whatever happens. I still believe in, you know, that's kind of the refrain in that article that I wrote. Americans care and engage, and we are called to turn towards our neighbor.
That's right.
And whatever party is in power, you know, even during communism, there we still were able to care for other people, to care for our neighbors, to preach the gospel, to trust God, and to be engaged in whatever way we can. So this is not escapism. This is putting our trust in God and then engaging and caring.
I think that's exactly right. And that's a great credo by which to live. I think anybody listening to you, Irena, would not take you at all for an escapist. You know, you're someone who is really able to face very difficult things and still engage them. And I think that just seems to be deeply woven into who you are, which I really admire. Let me ask this kind of in closing now, about kind of taking it back to where we're at now with that war in Ukraine that's brought so much of this to mind for so many of us, whether people like you have been so close to those kinds of things or people like me who watch them somewhat fearfully from afar. The question, I guess, is this: where do you hope we all are a year from now? I mean, clearly, we hope for the well-being and safety of people in Ukraine and for the innocent people in Russia who suffer at the hands of their political leaders, you know, but what about those of us not directly implicated in that conflict? What do you hope we come to understand from it?
Oh, yeah, that's a hard question. I've been pondering that and wondering, like, what is the answer? And the thing that I go back to, and again, kind of touching on that escapism, again, I hope that doesn't sound like it, but I was encouraged, actually, even just before we started talking, I got another text from my friend Aliona, who I write about, who is now safely in Portugal, actually, with her family. And we're going to talk later this afternoon. And, you know, the long journey of being a refugee began for her. So now they're safe and they ran. The dramatic escape is over. But now the long, sometimes that's harder, much harder, the long trek of being stripped bare and rebuilding your life and trusting God. And even as she was fleeing Ukraine, she would text us Psalms, and she would say, I'm reading Psalm 56. So a group of friends were all reading it with her. And so I would say, where are we going to be? Well, unless God's kingdom comes, we're still going to be here in the place where God's kingdom is not fully yet, but we are his representatives. We will be praying the Lord's Prayer, saying, God's kingdom come, your will be done, and surrendering things to God. I hope, you know, I think that's where we should be. We will be praying Psalms. We will be praying and saying, when I'm afraid, I put my trust in you, in God, whose word I praise. In God I trust and am not afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? I think that's where we're going to be. I think we're going to be in the middle of a paradox that life is, you know, joy and sorrow and chaos and clarity. But we will still be in the world where God is still the magic ingredient. where he still is present, where he does grant us aha moments of clarity in the middle of chaos, where he does infuse us with joy in the middle of pain. And I mean, that's nothing new. It's like, you know, God's kingdom, not yet, but still here because of God's presence. And one of them, I mentioned my brother who passed away, and he, his last message to me was a birthday card sent just a few weeks before he passed away. He died. And he sent me Psalm 20. So that's been one, like a hymn for me. And one of the verses in that Psalm 20 says, "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God." And I think that's it. Those chariots can sometimes be political parties or tanks or NATO or who knows what. And some trust in those chariots. And sometimes those chariots, you know, they're good to get us from place to place. But we trust in the name of our Lord. So I think that's where we're still going to be. And I think as a community, hopefully bonded closer together to remind each other and help each other pray Psalms. Because I think that's what those 5 days and ever since the war in Ukraine helped, is our group of friends and everyone texting each other and calling and saying, "I'm reading this Psalm, I'm reading this Psalm." And my friend just texted me, like I said, and she said, things are hard. And then she said all these things that are hard. And she said, "I keep going back to Psalms. They're beautiful, aren't they?" And this is my friend who's a refugee. And she says, "They're beautiful, aren't they?" So I think we're going to be praying lots of Psalms.
I think that's probably right. You know, I'm actually here at BYU. I'm actually part of a small group. And we meet on Mondays and go through a psalm and spend an hour on it together, one by one. And I'm with some remarkably insightful people, biblical scholars and philosophers and literary scholars, and it's been really wonderful. Whatever we can do to be closer together and to maintain that confidence in God, as you put it, Irena, I think that is certainly my answer and the answer of many of our listeners. Mm-hmm. You are so great to come on this podcast. I'm so grateful for your wonderful work and your perspective, your wisdom, and your really energetic, peace-seeking soul. I really admire it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. No, thank you, Matthew, for having me here. Like I said at the beginning, let me just repeat again. The gift of having my voice heard, and through me, Iona's voice heard as well, and my parents. I really do this to honor them. Thank you. That this is, it's a gift. And the way you think through these issues, thank you for the questions that you sent my way. I have so many notes, and I think you're prompting some more writing sessions for me, because your questions were so, hit the nail on the head, are just so poignant and wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for that gift.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.